From the Sky News Centre at 6, a couple have been found guilty of murdering a three-year-old boy who they were supposed to be looking after. Ryan Lavelle Hancox was subjected to a campaign of cruelty so severe it left him with dozens of injuries. Instead of babysitting him, Kaylee Boleyn and Christopher Taylor beat him at their bedsit in Bilston in the West Midlands. Detective Inspector Graham Squire from West Midlands Police says they may never know why the pair abused Ryan.
They've chosen to lie in police interviews and then to blame each other. We still don't know to this day what the exact version of events was.
The family of a young mother who died from cancer after doctors failed to spot it several times have received a six-figure payout. Princess of Wales Hospital in Bridgend sent Lavinia Bletchley home on three separate occasions, claiming there was nothing seriously wrong with her. But the family's solicitor, Julie Lewis, thinks doctors should have been more thorough.
The only appropriate action should have been a CT scan. A CT scan would have led very quickly to the diagnosis being made, chemotherapy being started, and Lavinia would be alive and she would still be with us today if that course of action had been followed.
The Vatican's hit back at claims the Pope turned a blind eye to a child sex scandal. The pontiff's accused of failing to act on allegations an American priest, Lawrence Murphy, abused as many as 200 young boys at a school for the deaf in Wisconsin. Manufacturers should start making fatty food and soft drinks in smaller portions. The Food Standards Agency is calling for the changes to help consumers choose a healthier diet. Formula One star Lewis Hamilton has had his Mercedes impounded for alleged motoring offences in Melbourne in Australia. He says that what he did was silly and has apologised to police. It's the end of an era on TV, ITV's axing police drama The Bill after more than a quarter of a century. The show was given a revamp last year, but it failed to win back viewers. ITV says it reflects the changing tastes of audiences. That's the latest. I'm Tim Charles.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
BCFM is a community radio station for Bristol.
So what exactly does that mean?
Well, it means that anybody can get involved in any way you want.
Yeah, but what if you haven't done radio before?
That doesn't matter, because BCFM have qualified tutors that run training courses that tell you everything you need to know.
To find out more information, go to www.bcfm.org.uk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time. In a minute, we take a look at the Irish Troubles and collusion between secretive units in the British Army with loyalist terrorists. Montpellier-based ex-soldier Bryn Richard Cowley reports. And is our economic and military crisis part of a calculated push for world government? Argentinian economist Adrian Salbucci believes powerful private societies behind the scenes have been quietly planning their own world government for nearly 100 years. But before all that, Dr. Alan Zabrowski is one of the most respected soldiers in the American forces. He has a PhD from the University of Michigan and graduated at the US Army War College, going on later to become its Director of Studies. He spent 10 years in Vietnam with the US Marine Corps and is an American of Jewish religion and ancestry. All the more remarkable then that he should be on the radio in the US this week saying that the Israeli secret service, the Mossad, carried out the 9/11 attacks. Now we'll be hearing from him in a minute and listening to what he had to say on US radio. But before that, Martin Summers is joining me here. Martin, we've had a couple of stories to do with the Mossad this week. I mean, we've had a development, probably most importantly, the expulsion of a senior Mossad person from the Israeli embassy in London. Why did that happen?
Well, it was because of the assassination in Dubai, where a dozen forged British passports had been used by the perpetrators, which appear to be Mossad.
So do you think that there is enough evidence to say that it was Mossad? Has this guy been expelled correctly?
Well, I mean, the British government probably have obviously concluded that it is, and the guy's been expelled therefore. I would question whether that's enough, frankly. I mean, this is a criminal offence. Ultimately, they're going to have to face criminal charges.
But it's quite a strong thing to do, isn't it, to a friendly country, an ally country, to actually expel one of their senior Secret Service people from the country. That's not a very friendly act by the Foreign Office.
Well, no, because that it's not a very friendly act by the Israelis to use British passports to murder people, is it? I mean, that puts all British tourists everywhere in the world at risk. Think about that, folks, as you're setting off for your holidays this summer.
But don't you think all of these secret services around the world do these kind of shady James Bond-type things? Surely this is not just the Israelis.
Yes, but all these secret services do all these shady James Bond-type things, as you put it. They don't break the 11th commandment, which is don't get caught. And I'm afraid the Israelis in this case have been caught.
So is that the only thing because they've got caught this time, you think that something needs to happen? Whereas maybe the British secret services and the Russians, the Chinese are doing this all the time.
Listen, we've got to kind of have a rule of law in the world. And I understand that the chief of police in Dubai has issued an Interpol warrant for the arrest of Benjamin Netanyahu and the head of Mossad, because he knows that they both agreed the operation before it took place. Now, this is a murder. That's as simple as that. It's a straightforward murder case. It's not a political matter.
Well, it's an assassination. Surely it's a political
assassination. We can call it an assassination.
It's a political murder.
Let's just call it murder, and then we know what we're talking about. Now, murders are illegal in Dubai, in Israel, everywhere. They're just illegal. And if somebody has been embroiled in commissioning a murder, even if they are the Prime Minister of Israel, they are a criminal, and they have to be chased by the police.
So the Israelis aren't doing too well in their relations with Britain and America at the moment as well, because Benjamin Netanyahu's been over in the US as well, hasn't he, Martin? What's been happening over there?
Well, I mean, Joseph Biden, who's the vice president, went to visit Israel quite recently for discussions, and he's a very pro-Israeli US politician. I mean, you could hardly find anybody who was more pro-Israeli than Joseph Biden. But even so, as he arrived in Israel, the Israelis announced that they were going to build more settlements in East Jerusalem, which is pretty provocative of them. And it seems to be that they did this quite deliberately in order to demonstrate that they could cock a snook at the Obama administration. And that's caused some bad blood between them and the White House.
Now, yes, but Netanyahu's actually over in the US at the moment, I believe. And hasn't there been a bit of a falling out between him and President Obama?
I think that's right. I mean, basically, the Obama administration has been pretty pro-Israel by any definition, as has our own government, frankly. But even the Americans are now beginning to wonder whether they can trust the Israelis. I mean, there have been UN resolutions about Israel passed this week in which Britain abstained and the Americans voted against. Now, if you want to win wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I say if, because of course we might, perhaps we shouldn't be involved in those wars at all, but if you want to win those wars, the first thing you've got to do is demonstrate that you're not, and you haven't got an anti-Muslim agenda. Now, the first way you can do that is get tough with Israel. But since we haven't got tough with Israel, Muslims around the world are concluding that in actual fact we are complicit in all of their bad behaviour, which of course puts our troops at risk.
Now, let's get back to what I was originally talking about, which is this chappy, Dr. Alan Zabrowski, S-A-B-R-O-S-K-Y. He is the ex-director of studies at the United States Army War College. And he has been saying, apparently last week, that he believes that the Israeli Secret Service, the Mossad, actually carried out the 9/11 attacks. So what exactly did he say and why? And why has it not been reported by the mainstream press in Europe and the United States? Let's have a listen, and then we'll be asking Martin why it's taken 10 years for Dr. Zabrowski to come to this conclusion.
What we need to stand up and say is not only did they attack the USS Liberty, they did 9/11. They did it. I have had long conversations over the past 2 weeks with contacts at the Army War College, at its headquarters, Marine Corps, and I've made it absolutely clear in both cases that it is 100% certain that 9/11 was a Mossad operation, period. For most Americans, you know, what happened to the USS Liberty or in Vietnam was history. You know, they can be concerned about it, but they're not going to get mad about it. 9/11 has led directly 60,000 Americans dead and wounded. God knows how many hundreds of thousands of people in other countries that we've killed or wounded or made homeless. And it's an ongoing sore. Well, this is an open wound. And what Americans need to understand is they did it. Mm-hmm. They did it. And if they do understand that, Israel's going to disappear. Well, if Americans ever know that Israel did this, they're going to scrub them off the earth, and they're not going to give a rat's ass, forgive my language, what the cost is. They are not going to care.
That was Dr. Alan Zabrowski there. He's former director of studies at the U.S. Army War College. So he should know, speaking on the radio in the United States last week. So, Martin, can you just tell us, is this a credible opinion?
I think it is. Somebody else that people might want to check out if they use the internet is, and I've mentioned him before, General Leonid Ivashov was the commander of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, and he's also of the opinion that the attack was carried out by Mossad and elements within the US security forces. They couldn't possibly have done it on their own.
Yes, but do the Israelis, the Mossad, have the means, motive and opportunity to run this massive attack on New York?
Not on their own. They must have had moles on the inside of the US security apparatus, and quite possibly in our own security apparatus here in Britain. We've got basically these kind of agencies are out of control. What's beginning to happen, of course, is that mainstream military people like Zaborsky are saying, look, we've had enough of this, and we want something to be done about it. The other thing that was mentioned there, of course, Tony, was the USS Liberty. The listeners may not know about that, but that was an event in 1967 where a US basically spy ship was attacked by Israeli warplanes, killing several scores of sailors, US sailors. And this was an attempt to make it look as if the Egyptians had attacked the ship, because the Israelis wanted the Americans to come in on their side in the 1967 war. So they attacked the USS Liberty with their own aircraft in hopes that they would be mistaken for an Egyptian attack, and that the Americans would be forced into a war. Now, this kind of relationship between the Americans and the Israelis has been going on for a long time. The question is who's the puppet and who's the puppet master. These kind of tricks and games are very much part of the history.
Well, it remains to be seen as to whether Dr. Zabrowski is listened to, whether he's right or wrong. But if he's bumped off, as a senior person, if he's the guy who's running courses at the United States Army War College and he's trusted to that extent, surely he's someone we should be listening to.
Well, what was most interesting about what he said, the actual fact, he said, "I know that senior military figures in the US, not just me, other people are aware of what's happened." Now, you can see how difficult it is. Say you are a military figure and you suddenly realise what's going on. What do you do? I've often put this question to people. What would you do if you were an honest policeman in Nazi Germany? At what point do you try to stand up to what's going on? How do you stand up to what's going on? Particularly, so for example, if your bosses are in on it, and so on and so forth. It's difficult, very difficult.
Thank you. Right. So, throughout the Irish Troubles in the 1970s and 80s, there were rumours that secretive elements in the British Army intelligence were working closely with loyalist terrorists, such as the Ulster Volunteer Force and the Ulster Freedom Fighters. It was later shown that a secretive group called the Force Research Unit had been supplying terrorists with guns and explosives, training them to use them for attacks in the Irish Republic and in the North, at British taxpayers' expense. These illegal acts by secret army units have become known as collusion. After the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, Sir John Stevens was tasked with investigating allegations of collusion, which even included loyalist gangs passing lists of suspected IRA members to the SAS for assassination in the notorious shoot-to-kill policy. Sir John Stevens even had his office in Northern Ireland Police Station mysteriously burnt out one night during the inquiry, but had wisely kept duplicate copies of all documents back on the British mainland. So what have we learned in the last 10 years about collusion? What was going on at British taxpayers' expense in Northern Ireland? And was this a few rogue army officers, or did the decisions go right to the top? Montpellier-based ex-soldier Bryn Richard Cowley has been looking into collusion and joins me now. Hi, Richard.
Good evening, Tony. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
So what was meant by the term collusion in the context of the Stevens inquiry?
I just like to say that I'm also now studying LLB law myself, which brings me to this point.
What does LLB stand for, LLB law, since you're studying it? You're not sure? Okay.
It means that you're a qualified lawyer, doesn't it? Yeah, I think
no,
so.
No, you're studying law.
Yes, I know, but once you've got the degree, you're qualified as a lawyer,
okay,
aren't you?
Right. Anyway, carry on. Anyway. What was meant by the term collusion in the context of the Stevens inquiry?
Okay. The term collusion is usually addressed actually to financial matters, but in this case, because of the context in Northern Ireland, Sir John Stevens is using it in a different way, and he says that essentially it's the failure to keep records or the existence of contradictory accounts which can often be perceived as evidence of concealment or malpractice, which further limits the opportunity to rebut serious allegations against, for example, special branch or military intelligence. They're also guilty of the absence of accountability. This means that it allows the acts or omissions of individuals to then go undetected. He then accuses them of withholding of information, which then impedes the prevention of crime and the arrest of suspects. The unlawful involvement of agents in murder implies that the security forces, i.e. MI5, Special Forces, etc., are also sanctioning killings. And that collective of information there is what Sir John Stevens classifies as being collusion.
Okay, so how many deaths occurred through collusion? Do you have any idea?
It's hard to say, Tony, isn't it? We don't know how far it goes.
Let's let Bryn answer.
We're talking about perhaps over 20,000 injured and maybe over 3,000 dead in the total troubles.
Yeah. Which but that's not just the collusionary trouble. That's everybody's bad behaviour, isn't it?
In terms of John Stevens' accountability in this, in the inquiry, he specifically talks about Lambert and Finucane in particular in the third part of his inquiry. But there was during for example his first 3 years of inquiry from 1987 to 1989, the RUC dealt with over 3,000 terrorist related incidences where 261 deaths did occur during his first 3 years of his inquiry. Gives you some idea of the trouble.
What we know about collusion is the tip of the iceberg. So we know that scores of people probably died, but we don't know how many others might, because we don't know what happened and we've not got to the bottom of it. We're not sure exactly how many people might be implicated in this.
Okay, so the big question is, could these deaths have been prevented?
I think that's in the inquiry. Sir John specifically states, I quote here, I also believe that the RUC investigation of Patrick Finucane's murder in specific should have resulted in the early arrest and detection of his killers. William Stobey, which was the quartermaster of the UDA, did in fact supply information on the planning of Finucane's murder prior to the incident.
He ended up getting shot dead, did he not, on the steps of Belfast Crown Court?
Yeah.
Silence him.
He was eventually executed by the UDA themselves for supplying information to the press, basically, or leaking information.
Okay, so was this incompetence in British intelligence, or do you think that the collusion was deliberate?
Again, Sir John recommends recommended a review of all police procedures into terrorist offences and retraining special branch officers, which I presume he means the RUC, and agreements among all departments and agencies to ensure clarity of roles. And he says, I also propose some new recommendations concerning the future policing of Northern Ireland as a whole.
Okay, so is this a characteristic now accepted as incompetence in police procedures?
It seems to run particularly as characteristic in Northern Ireland in conjunction to the Troubles and in context to the plethora of confusion. He mentions that he investigated the allegation that senior RUC officers were briefing the Home Office Minister, Douglas Hogg, and told him that some solicitors were unduly sympathetic to the IRA cause, in which he was obviously referring to Pat Finucane at that point. But unfortunately, Douglas Hogg controversially then repeated this view during the prevention of terrorism legislation during the House of Commons. And a week later, the solicitor, Pat Finucane, was then murdered. Sir John said that the comments made by Douglas Hogg QC were not justifiable, and that Douglas Hogg had been compromised. So this obviously shows further incompetence all round, especially by a senior minister. You would have thought better of, you know, especially in context to potentially provoking action against the solicitor.
Were Catholics targeted by the Northern Ireland police more than Protestants?
The answer to that is yes. In a damning section of Sir John's report, he actually accuses the IUC of not treating Catholics thought to be at risk on the same par with Protestants, saying, quote, "Nationalists were known to be targeted, but were not properly warned or protected." And then he goes on to say that the community were not dealt with in equal measure. So, yes, they were. That's the
answer. Do the IRA collude with Sinn Féin or the real IRA? Collude with the provisional IRA, etc. So I'm talking about, is there collusion on the Republican side as well?
I'm afraid I'm going to have to say that there is. In fact, in 1970 in particular, there is reference to the fact that collusion by ministers from the Republic of Ireland did plot to send arms to the IRA across the border, and that the Irish state went to extraordinary lengths to stop the extradition of murderers to the UK, or that the Irish Garda helped violent IRA members of the establishment with safe houses. Their paramilitary is on the run, for example. And in this, I have to say that Dermot Finucane, which is the brother of Pat Finucane, successfully contested attempts to extradite him to Northern Ireland from the Republic for his part in the killing of a prison officer. He was actually one of 38 IRA prisoners who escaped from the maze in 1983.
So the army rely on good intelligence, or else they're going to start hitting the wrong targets. Is there any quality control?
Quality control is a very important point, isn't it? That the coordination, according to John Stevens, and the dissemination and the sharing of intelligence was extremely poor. Informants and agents, for example, were allowed to operate without effective control and to participate in terrorist crimes. And crucial information was withheld from senior investigating officers. We could say that Brian Nelson, for example, had warned Gordon Kerr of the Forces Research Unit of a plan to, in fact, assassinate Pat Finucane beforehand. We could give the example also of incompetence where Sir John gave another example of William Stobie, the UDA quartermaster, who was involved in the 1987 murder of Adam Lambert, a Protestant student who was mistaken for an IRA Catholic on a building site. So that was bad information.
So who specifically did Sir John Stevens implicate in the state crime of collusion?
Sir John specifically points the finger at the Royal Ulster Constabulary Special Branch, and in particular at the British Military Force Research Unit, a branch of the Army Intelligence, which he suspected had become particularly involved in more lethal illegalities. Brigadier Gordon Kerr was the, as he is now known, was then the colonel in charge, in amongst others, which were filed with the Northern Ireland Director of Public Prosecutions due to being suspected during the inquiry.
So who was this chap, Brigadier Gordon Kerr?
Gordon Kerr covered, basically his job was to cover the collection and use of intelligence by British forces. The use of British agents in conjunction with gathering intelligence, and the use of agents in conjunction with murders or assassinations, and to control the standard of the investigation. But we could also...
Brigadier Gordon Kerr is a key figure in all of this, and people might like to know what happened to him. Is he was originally posted to Beijing as military attaché. John Ware from Panorama doorstepped him in the British Embassy in Beijing, and he just slammed the door in his face. And people might like to know where he is now. He's actually in the Green Zone in Baghdad, according to the Glasgow Sunday Herald,
running something called a joint services group.
So,
from being punished, he was promoted to brigadier, and he's now running something on behalf of the British taxpayer in Iraq.
So the joint services group, do you think this is another one of those sort of weird names that doesn't really mean anything, a bit like the Force Research Unit?
Indeed, indeed, and therefore you've got no idea what that actually does from the name.
You know, I suppose they can't really call it the Terrorist Liaison Brigade or something, can they?
Well, he's in a system, and it has to be said fairly that whilst you're in a system, you're obliged to follow whatever protocols are, you know, put in front of you. Now, Gordon Kerr, during his time in Force Research Unit Northern Ireland, said that his job was to inform the police of possible assassination attempts against individuals. And Kerr said quite plainly that he wished to help the army in its attempt to counter terrorism and to save life. And so the Forces Research Unit was nevertheless a highly secretive unit which sought to identify, nevertheless, and recruit both IRA Republican loyalists and British loyalists as spies, basically.
So John Stevens had all sorts of problems during this inquiry. How was he obstructed?
Yeah, that's right. There was a lot of obstruction during his inquiries, as in fact happened to John Stalker, if you remember that incident. So John stated that that he was obstructed every step of his inquiries, basically, and he quotes here saying that this obstruction was cultural in its nature and widespread within parts of the army, particularly in the RUC. And he said there was crucial evidence which was concealed by, in particular, the Forces Research Unit. He and his team were able to nevertheless discover the whereabouts and the identity of Brian Nelson as a leading agent and the head of the UDA intelligence group without their help. The investigation into collusion resulted, nevertheless, in the jailing of Brian Nelson. there's Gordon Kerr that said that the UDA was planning to, or should I say that Brian Nelson had warned Gordon Kerr that the UDA was planning to kill Pat Finnegan, the solicitor, but no action was taken by him.
So who were the main people who were helping British intelligence?
There's a short list that's been detailed in the Stevens inquiry that ranges essentially from James Spence, who was supposed to be the UDA godfather, but I'm not quite sure what that means, and there was Ken Barrett, Brian Nelson, both of which were also loyalist paramilitaries, high-ranking ones, nevertheless. And then there was William Stobie, the quartermaster of the UDA. Those people in particular seem to have been highlighted. And Ken Barrett was the guy that supposedly murdered, or he was, in fact he was, sorry, he murdered Pat Finnegan, the solicitor. Brian Nelson drove him to the actual location. One thing about Ken Barrett, and he's now been arrested and he's been sentenced to 22 years minimum for a number of murders that he admitted to. And under the early release program, most terrorists convicted before the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, who have served at least 2 years in prison, were considered for release. But unfortunately, Barrett doesn't qualify for that, as he is served his sentence outside of Northern Ireland. And I'm kind of, you know, studying law, I'd like to query that and wonder whether he should be considered for release pretty much immediately in conjunction to this.
So did collusion go as far as deliberate lies and disinformation?
Yeah, a lot of misinformation was issued by the RUC and the British Army in relation to ships to attacks. For example, the RUC has often told families and family members that an attack was carried out by the IRA when they knew very well that the perpetrators actually included members of their own force, the UDR.
So, how were the SAS also included in this collusion?
Yeah, in standard practice, you can assume that the SAS are pretty much everywhere. They're fairly thin on the ground and they get up to every hanky-panky skullduggery concept you can imagine, because basically they're the speared leading troops, and if there's any killing that needs to be done, that responsible action needs to be taken, they are basically the ones that supervise and coordinate it. You know, they train 14 intern, they're the specialists, basically at the top of the pile. there was a link, nevertheless, amongst elements of the UDA and the UVF and Special Branch with the SAS in specific in Portadown area. The Special Branch officer that we're talking about here, which I believe is possibly Kerr, was linked to the SAS covert troop based at Castle Dillon, HQ 3 Brigade. And he was said to have provided weapons which were not handed into the IUC forensics, instead to the SAS commanders, then who in turn passed the buck of the pass, as it were, and used the SAS troop facilities and the Special Branch introductions to arm and task loyalist gangs. So there's a lot of collusion and passing the parcel there, you know, to sort of like avoid blame, as it were. The Garda actually nicknamed this suspicious character, this elusive chap, as the Badger, and his Garda friends to clear areas to enable border crossings for both the SAS, UDA and the UVF operations.
I think if anyone's interested in finding out more about the SAS involvement in the Troubles, one of the books I'd recommend is The Nemesis File, The True Story of an SAS Execution Squad, which is a hardback book. The author is Paul Bruce, which is actually a pseudonym, but The Nemesis File is quite an incredible read. The author was a tough and idealistic young trooper when his crack SAS unit was sent to Northern Ireland, their top secret mission to summarily execute unarmed suspected members of the IRA under the complicit direction of the intelligence services, Parliament and the Prime Minister. The Nemesis File chronicles Bruce's participation in this grisly secret war. Anyway, back to you. And the next question, Richard, is did the UDA terrorists collude with the official army regiment, the UDR?
Yeah, okay. I was going to just sum up by mentioning the Robert Narek issue, but I'll move on if you like. Do you want to talk about what was that you were just saying?
The UDR. Did the UDA terrorists collude with the official army regiment? That
okay.
is the UDR.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many different little three-letter acronyms here. The UVF, UDA. The UDR is the Ulster Defence Regiment, which was the official army unit.
Yeah. The UDR is the Ulster Defence Regiment, and the UDA is the Ulster Defence Association. One of them is legal, and the other's not.
So see, the UDA remained legal throughout the Troubles. The IRA was always made illegal, but the UDA had a legal status.
Okay, back to you then, Richard.
The declassification of documents which were exposed in 2004 and dated back to 1970 indicated that 15% of known legitimate UDR troops were also acting members of the loyalist UDA. In August 1989, the illegal UDA claimed that they had received security force files on IRA target suspects, you know, in this sort of directional feed back and forward. Since the late 90s, loyalists have confirmed this, and to journalist Peter Taylor, that they did in fact receive dossiers and intelligence on IRA Republican targets from military intelligence sources. Yeah, dating back to 1970, 200 known weapons were passed from the UDR to the UDA illegally, or were stolen by the UDA from the UDR arsenal. And despite this knowledge, nevertheless, the British government increased their strength. In the mid-70s, the RUC were implicated, in aiding and participating in a number of sectarian murders in the Mid-Ulster area, which included the Reavy and the O'Dowd killings of 76. Two RUC members, John Weir and Billy McCaughey, were convicted in 1980 of the 77 murders on an attack on a pub in Keady and the kidnapping of a priest. But they then implicated immediately afterwards 11 colleagues of theirs in other killings and alleged that they were part of a wider conspiracy involving the RUC Special Branch, British military intelligence and the UVF.
Yeah, I can also remember myself seeing an account of an incident where the terrorists had actually set up a roadblock, but they had Ulster Defence Regiment uniforms and weapons,
yeah.
So they were posing as official soldiers.
You're talking about the Miami show band at that point. Yeah. Okay. So
anyway, Brian Nelson, who was he? Because you mentioned him a couple of times now. Who was he and how was he involved in collusion?
Okay, well, can I just quickly finish off here? But because... All right, I'll leave that question then. Brian Nelson, in specific, was a high-ranking player in all of this. And in 1987, Brian Nelson, codenamed 6137, began supplying British intelligence with target lists to be hit. Nelson became head of the UDA intelligence gathering activities for the FRU, that's the Forces Research Unit, in other words, KUR. Eventually, he pleaded guilty to 5 charges of conspiracy to murder and 14 charges of possessing information useful to terrorist interests. So he was there, obviously jailed. He also pleaded guilty to British Army complicity and admitted British Army complicity, which included murder and the importation of arms. In January 2007, the police ombudsman, Noella Olon, stated that the UFV informers committed crimes including murder with the full knowledge of British intelligence. And the reports alleged that Special Branch in particular created false documents, blocked evidence searches, and chaperoned suspects through interviews.
So, Richard, was this a few rogue army officers, or do you think the decisions did go to the top?
It's difficult to define what is meant by the top, i.e. number 10.
I mean, by, you know, real political control. Maybe you want to come in on this as well, Martin.
I think it's hard for us to say, because none of this has actually been properly tried in court. I think it's also fair to say that the Republican movement were engaged in similar kind of conspiracies to murder. But the importance of this is that the state is no better and no worse than the people that they are fighting. And I think that we all have to take a step back from those terrible years and recognise that everybody on all sides has got much to be ashamed of in what happened. And hopefully we can put it behind us, by talking about it, put it behind us and move on into a better future.
Just to summarise the actual conclusion of the inquiry, during the course of the 3 inquiries, over 9,000 statements were taken and 10,000 documents recorded, totaling over 1 million pages of information, and 16,000 exhibits seized, which, in fact, during its 15 years that it ran, led to the arrest of only 144 people, and so far only 94 of those have actually been convicted.
So, Richard, listening to all you've got to say is quite disturbing. Can we trust the police, the army and the government?
No, definitely not. You can take that to the bank.
Okay. Do you think things have changed since the days we're talking about? After all, this is, you know, over 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think that since Blair's introduced himself and become a Catholic and modified a lot of cultural differences, you know, everyone's learned from that.
I think the other point to make is that the police service of Northern Ireland now, the devolving of powers to the Assembly over policing, with the agreement of cross-party agreement in the community, apart from some grumbling from the UUP, there's no reason for anybody not to support the new police service for Northern Ireland. It's the whole community. By digging through the past and getting it out of the way, we can move forward in a more constructive way, hopefully.
It's very important to stress the fact that you can't go around killing in principle solicitors irrespectively of who they're defending, because that's just right out of order.
Well, that's apparently what the guy with the shooting said. You want me to kill a solicitor? And they said yes. And said that's normally against the rules.
And in fact, a number of paramilitaries even saw this, including William Stobie and indeed Brian Nelson.
This is a fascinating report, this Stevens report. It was a long time coming. Can we find it on the internet? Is it actually up there in cyberspace?
Yeah, the internet does have a copy of the actual report, detailed, minuted findings of the conclusion.
Bryn Cowley, thanks very much. And next week, we'll be looking at the Good Friday Agreement, as it is, in fact, Good Friday. How's it holding up 12 years on? Now, Adrian Salbucci is an Argentinian economist and author, and is a founding member of the Centre for Economic Studies in Buenos Aires. He's now the host of a Buenos Aires talk show, El Traductor Radial. He's also the founder of the Argentine Second Republic movement, known as Argentina Crisis. Now, Martin, why might be interested in what the Argentinian economists have to say?
You're asking me?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Well, Argentina obviously has had plenty of experience of economic crisis, so the kind of things that have been happening in Argentina are quite likely to be happening elsewhere.
When was the crisis in Argentina? Because I can remember, I think they had three presidents within 2 weeks.
Well, they've had lots of crises. It depends which one you're talking about. There's always been a lot of problems with the Argentine economy, with international debt and so on. But I think the one you're referring to is in the early 2000s.
So I think it was, yes, 2001, 2002. What actually happened to the Argentinian economy?
Well, basically, they're caught in a debt trap like everybody else. You owe loads and loads of money to the private banks, which means that you raise taxes in your country, but you can't actually spend it on anything you want. You've actually got to hand the money over to the banks elsewhere. And at a certain point, of course, you just run out of steam because, you're basically being bled dry. And it's not just Argentina this has happened to. It's happened to lots of countries. And obviously, there's a real danger of this happening, a new wave of this taking place as we speak.
So let's have a listen to Argentinian economist and author Adrian Salbucci.
This can best be grasped if we look at this global financial crisis within a much grander scheme, which is the so-called New World Order. We hear a lot about the New World Order these days. We know something is happening out there, but we're not quite sure what. In a way where there's smoke, there is fire, and we can see that the New World Order fire is spreading and spreading quickly. Seeing the state of the dire state of the world nowadays, our instinct tells us that there is definitely something wrong. Something is rotten, and not exactly in the state of Denmark. But the excuse seems to be, it's the New World Order. And I'd like to talk about the New World Order. The New World Order really is a generic term. It's a description of the overhaul to go into the next stage. Let's look back in history. We had a New World Order in 1919 when the victorious allies, Britain, France, and the United States, defeated the Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Turkish Empire. It was very politically centered, but they did get together in Paris, France, to plan out the New World Order. And that sort of guaranteed, the conditions were so bad against Germany and the defeated powers, that it guaranteed the Second World War. But the important thing is that at that time, in 1919, to plan out the New World Order, they founded two organizations, the New York-based Council on Foreign Relations and the London-based Royal Institute of International Affairs, also known as Chatham House. It destroyed, that New World Order had achieved destroying the conservative monarchies and preparing the way for socialisms, communism, even national socialism and other socialisms. Then we had the Second World War. And in 1945, again they met to prepare a New World Order. And what was that New World Order? Well, after Yalta and the division of the world, it was basically splitting the world up between the United States and its allies and the Soviet Union and its allies. And they also prepared a very economically centered New World Order. They founded the Bretton Woods Conference, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Trade Organization. It was the USSR against the USA. And now, when we get to 1991, again, George H.W. Bush Sr. announced in 1991 that we had a New World Order because the Soviet Union had collapsed, and the New World Order at that time was globalization, which was the consolidation of private power, and it was the consolidation of the deregulation of the economy and so forth. And what do we have today in 2009, the advent of another New World Order. And this time, the New World Order will not be mere globalization. It is something much stronger and much more dangerous. It is world government. On 8th December 2008, the Financial Times in London published an article by one of their main journalists, Mr. Gideon Rachman, where Mr. Rachman says in an article, the title of which says it all, the title said, "And now it's world government. Let's go for world government." And what he says is that there are basically three major crises in the world: the global warming crisis, the global financial crisis, and of course, global terrorism, that require a global solution. And he says, I'm not talking about governability or governance. I'm not talking about international cooperation. I am talking about world government. That means a lot for everybody. So what do they talk about when they say world government? Well, first of all, we've had world government for much longer than you think. We just don't see it, because we always think of government as something public. with all the trappings and symbols of public government. The flag, the president in the Oval Office, hail to the chief when he gets on, when he comes on in official, in his official capacity, military honors, intense media coverage. In the this is so in the United States, in Europe, in Argentina, whether it's the White House, whether it's 10 Downing Street, whether it's the Casa Rosada in Argentina, whether it's Capitol Hill. But if you analyze it, the most profound change that the world has undergone in the last 40 years is that power, the capacity to do, the capacity to make things happen in one way and not in another, that power, which is colossal, has been privatized. We talk a lot about privatizations, and we think of the telephone companies, the railways, I don't know, the gas company. Okay, those are operational privatizations, but the real privatization of the last 30 or 40 years is the privatization of power. And this is where public opinion gets confused, because we think, and rightly so, that public institutions, government institutions, are there to promote the common good, or at least they should be there. However, if we have a private world government, which is run by private institutions, as we will see in a moment, then we've got a problem, because private institutions don't really have an obligation, a legitimate obligation, to work for the common good. Private organizations, legitimately so, work for their own good. So there we have one of the keys to the problem. We have a world government, but it is mostly private, and the private institutions running the world government are not geared or focused on the common good. So what we have nowadays is private power. And private power is the power running the world government. Can we see it? Not easy. Is it a conspiracy? No way. And I'm going to tell you why. Because the organizations running this until now private world government have names, addresses, websites, emails, they issue documents, they publish books, they have logos, they make reports. It's all out there. All you need to do is, like a jigsaw puzzle, put the pieces together. Keep in mind, however, the following, that whilst public power organizations, government, are very rigid, monolithic, vertical, and sluggish, the branches of government, the executive, the legislative, the judiciary, the levels of government, national or state or federal, state or provincial, as in Argentina we have provinces, and municipal. But it's very, very structured and very sluggish. Private power has given itself the necessary global institutions to manage itself, and private power institutions are highly flexible. Operationally, they're very horizontal, or although it's vertical in the chain of command, they are adaptable and they move very fast, like quicksilver. Basically, the world's private power organizations can be described as a vast, loose, global network of think tanks, NGOs, non-government organizations, and lobbies, centered basically in the industrialized world. I would say there are about 2,000 of these think tanks the world over. And since this is very vertical in the chain of command, of those 2,000 think tanks, there are 200 that are the ones that are really that really count. And of those 200, there are 20 that really have clout. And of those 20, there are 4 or 5 that sit at the very pinnacle of this global power pyramid. And those 4 or 5 have names. It's no conspiracy, and I'm going to name them for you. You probably know this. It's the Council on Foreign Relations, founded in 1919 when they had to prepare the New World Order after the First World War. It's its sister organization, the RIAA, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, as it is called, based in London, also founded in 1919. It's the so-called Bilderberger Conference, founded in 1954, and that is probably the most powerful of these 4 or 5 that I'm going to describe, and it's been magnificently described and explained in a book by the Spanish author Daniel Estulin, and that was founded in 1954. And it's the Trilateral Commission, founded by Rockefeller and Kissinger and other the Rothschilds back in 1973 to coordinate the actions of the United States, Western Europe at that time, and Japan, and it's grown ever since. And here's where you can find some patterns which help to explain how this world government works. I've written a book called El Cerebro del Mundo, la Cara Oculta de la Globalización. It's in Spanish, and it would translate as The World's Mastermind, The Hidden Face of Globalization. This book analyzes, studies this private world government, and it does so pretty much centered on the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. And the Council on Foreign Relations in New York is an example I'd like to take because it helps to explain what's really happening.
That was Adrian Salbucci. He's Argentinian economist and author, host of the Buenos Aires talk show El Traductor Radial. So, Martin, what do you think about that? Is he right to say that our government is becoming increasingly privatised behind the scenes?
Well, it's a common place to say such things, isn't it? I mean, it's pretty obvious that there are powerful forces at work shaping the world in the directions they want to shape it.
And what do you think about this idea of think tanks and policy, people who are making policy? You know, how much...
Well, the great...
this is all funded privately,
isn't it?
It is,
yes. And the great heyday of think tanks, of course, was after you had a sort of radical surge in the universities in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s. A lot of that kind of think tankery used to be done inside the university system. But the big corporations decided that the universities, in fact, were not reliable from their point of view. And that's when think tanks really began to become a big deal. And, of course, that basically means that you've got a private institution, privately funded. It's not answerable to anybody. There's no kind of accountability. They've become very, very influential.
OK, now let's go back to the second half of that talk, recorded late last year by Argentinian economist and author Adrian Salbucci, talking about specifically the Council on Foreign Relations.
The CFR, as they are called, has about 4,500 US-based members. They issue an annual report. It's for free. All you have to do is write to them and ask them, and they'll send it to you for free. And amongst other things, at the very end of the book, they will give you the full list of the 4,500 members. It's in beautifully alphabetical order. And when you start looking at the list, you say, well, a lot of names I know. Bill Clinton, Alan Greenspan, George H.W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Robert Gates, the defense minister, George Soros, Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Charles Prince, William Rhodes, and Robert Rubin of Citicorp fame, David Rockefeller, Maurice Greenberg of AIG, Madeleine Albright, Stanley Fisher and Ann Kruger, who used to be with the IMF, Susan Rice and Condoleezza Rice, one is a Democrat, the other one is a Republican, Timothy Geithner, we know them all. Henry Paulson, James Wolfensohn, Lawrence Summers, Paul Volcker, ex-former governor of the Federal Reserve Bank. However, most of those 4,500 people, at least in Argentina, we haven't a clue who they are. But I took the trouble, and a lot of people have, of trying to find out who are these people. And when you look at who are these people, you find that you have the key decision makers and the key people running the 500 largest corporations in America, the Fortune 500, the major banks, the ones who actually receive your dollars and they give it back, maybe, the major multilateral organizations like the IMF, the World Bank, and other such organizations, and the people running them, Stanley Fisher, Ann Kruger, Robert Sowelic at the World Bank, the Federal Reserve Board in the United States, which is running the US dollar, the major universities as far as economic and political science are concerned, Yale, Princeton, Harvard, Chicago, MIT, and so forth, the multimedia telling you what's news and what is not news, and when they tell you something is news, how they're going to deliver it, ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox News, and so forth. And very important, the key job posts in government, in the federal government, in the state governments, Congress, and so forth, systematically over the past 60 years, the president or vice president, the secretary of state, the secretary of the treasury, the intelligence community, the key embassies abroad, the defense secretary, and other such key posts, they've always been in the hands of people coming from the CFR. It doesn't matter whether they're Republicans or Democrats. Many of these people have multi-memberships. They are also members of the Trilateral Commission. They are also members of the RAND Corporation, the Cato Corporation, the Brookings Institution, the Bilderberg Groups, naturally, and so forth. If I were to describe to you the wheel of power in this world, I think you would agree that we could take, say, six spikes of power, which are the ones I just mentioned: corporate America, financial institutions, multilateral agencies running the system as a whole, Ivy League universities, the multimedia, and government. And you would say, well, these six spikes, why does the wheel of power on a global basis turn in the direction that it does towards this horrendous world government that we are about to see, and not in a more kinder, gentler direction? Well, basically because that wheel of power is driven from a hub. And that hub is the low profile but high power network of global institutions and think tanks that are actually planning the New World Order. And they do this on a long-term basis. It takes literally decades. And the important thing is that whilst the planning takes place at the CFR, the Trilateral Commission, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the Bilderberg Group, no actions are taken from the CFR and the Bilderbergs and the Trilaterals. The important thing is that the decisions taken are then operated by each individual from his natural place of activity, whether it be as a CEO of a major corporation, the CEO of a bank, the deputy director of the IMF, or the vice president or president of the United States or secretary of the Treasury. Look, the best way to describe this would be with a simile. This functions like a symphony orchestra. Many of you, I certainly do, probably have heard Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the Chorale Symphony. And you probably, if you go to the theater, you will find when you go to the theater that there are first violins, 16 of them, second violins, violas, cellos, basses, woodwind instruments, brass or the metal instruments, percussion, a chorus of singers, and four soloist singers. Perhaps there are 200 people on stage, each of them talented and ready to generate the sound, whether it be from the violin, from the trumpet, or from his own voice, to start putting together and making Beethoven's Ninth Symphony a reality. But there is one special exception to this. It's a gentleman who appears on stage with his back to the audience, with a little stick in his hand, and he starts directing, and he makes no noise, no sound whatsoever. But he is the one who stands in the middle and hears the entire mass of music, and he knows that the violins have to sound a little bit stronger, that the brass has to play it down a little bit, and if there is any small mistake or small error on the part of any of the singers, he brings it all together. He is the man who ensures that the entire mass of sound coming out of the orchestra pit and out of the chorus and out of the singers is exact, balanced, perfect, the way it should be. But he is not doing it because he's a dictator or according to his own whim. He is doing it based on a piece of paper called a musical score, which in this case is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in D minor, the chorale. And he is doing this based on that score, and that score was not written yesterday. That score was written by Ludwig van Beethoven in 1825. So look at that. We're hearing the orchestra play music that was composed 180 years ago. It's very important that we understand this, because in a way, the conductor of this New World Order is this hub, this network of loosely tied together but very strong and powerful think tanks with the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and the Bilderbergs at the very center. They are the ones with a low profile and a lot of clout who make the whole thing happen. It's very important that we understand that this is the way the world really works. It's a model, and that also helps to explain the present global financial crisis. It's a necessary, painful stage on the way to world government. And when you understand that something is part of a model, it becomes, as I say, understandable. And that which can be explained and understood can be predicted. So, for example, going back to the example of Beethoven, if I'm sitting in the theater listening to the second movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, I already know that there's a third movement on the way and that there is a fourth movement on the way. And if I know my Beethoven, I will know exactly how they sound. So I can predict what will be happening in the next 40 or 50 minutes.
That was Argentinian economist and author Adrian Salbucci. He's founding member of the Center for Economic Studies in Buenos Aires. He's also host of Buenos Aires talk show El Traductor Radial and a founder member of the Argentine Second Republic movement known as Argentina Crisis. You can find much more of Adrian Salbucci's analysis up on the World Wide Web. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where via our Barton Hill transmitter we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. And we bring you the city's top investigative reports. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme or would like to suggest a guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest. And that was Chair of Bristol City Council Licensing Committee and Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove, Mary Sykes, who's standing down at this forthcoming local election. Thanks also to our resident Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers, and also to Bryn Richard Cowley for this week's report on collusion in Northern Ireland. Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, we have a politician-free Good Friday special. Martin and I will be playing some music and dipping into internet radio from around the world. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all previous Friday Drive Times, including my hour-long report on mobile phone masts and wireless safety, as well as the investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose. And you can find out what's coming up next week. Go to bcfm.org.uk and click on Presenters or Podcasts to find my page. A podcast of this show is usually you online by the midnight after BCFM broadcast. Up next, it's Somali language programming with BCFM Nemo and Somali Youth. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
And is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.